Hello, and welcome back to Lovecraft Country Critical. Yay!
Yay!
We are back to talk about episode 4 today, A History of Violence. And I'm joined by a very, very sleepy Len in Australia.
Very sleepy, yes, very sleepy. Hello. I'll wake up right now drinking my double espresso iced coffee to get me through this podcast and the morning.
And possibly also an equally sleepy Lucy.
Yep, pretty sleepy over here, even though there's no iced coffee for me, no double espresso.
Get it in ya.
Maybe that's the problem.
Yeah, that is the problem.
And I'm Emma, in case you don't know this lovely voice. We are here today to talk about the HBO series Lovecraft Country. Hopefully you've listened to our other episodes. If you haven't, go back and listen to them after this or before.
Check them out.
How many hours you got free. But we are going to go through the episode itself, talk about the plot, things that come up around the episode. Then we will take a trip to Cthulhu Corner, where we talk about differences between the book
and
the show.
All hail Cthulhu.
Indeed, as well as some Lovecraftian hints and references before we talk about some listener feedback, and then that's the end of the show. But before we get into our thoughts on the episode, I want to address something that's come up over the last couple of weeks.
This is not regular scheduled programming. No. I am
interrupting
confused.
Your regular programming.
Do not adjust your set.
I want to talk about feedback. So, listener feedback, we love it. We always take into consideration what comes through to us so that we can make this podcast the best it can be for the people that listen and for us. Yay.
That is why we do it, for the listeners. That is why we do it, to be fair.
It is, and we love you all.
It's definitely not for financial gain. I'm just going to put that out right now.
Or for love of the craft.
We don't do it for financial gain. It's for the love of the craft, but not the love of Lovecraft, if you get what I mean. Yeah, okay.
Yes, indeed. But recently, we've had a couple of reviews that have raised some opinions about our approach to the racism and racial themes throughout Lovecraft Country. So I wanted to bring this up before we talk about this episode. So most of the feedback that we've had for this series has been overwhelmingly positive. But there are a handful of people who've questioned, I think, our understanding and how much we discuss the events and racial tensions and references within the show. So I just wanted to say thank you for your feedback. We do really appreciate it and we always take it on board. And as a podcast, we always try to acknowledge and address every element of a show, especially those that are important and resonant, especially at the current time, but at all times, obviously. So I would like every listener, but especially those who have come to us with that feedback, to know that we're not intending to ignore any of those racial elements. I do think actually that we do address them, and we try to do that evenly alongside the Lovecraftian science fiction horror stuff. But we also, I think it's pretty important to say, aren't here to put forward a history lesson. And, you know, we are learning as we go along too. And I think that's probably quite evident from here. You know, we're not ignorant to things that have happened in history. But I want to make clear that us learning about it, or maybe not picking up on everything, doesn't mean we're ignoring it. And we support every single one of our audience, whoever you are. So we appreciate not everyone's going to enjoy our coverage. You might have opinions, but I just wanted to bring that up.
Well, yeah, very good. Very good opener. Very interesting discussion to open with. It is a tough show to cover because I have found that online, be it whether it's reviews of the actual episodes, whether it's different threads on subreddit, the show is extremely divisive and it is causing people to have many arguments with each other about whether or not certain things are being represented in the correct manner and whether or not people are noticing those things being represented. And it's tricky. Like we try our best. You know, we have very long episodes. We try and cram everything in, whether that's the references to other pulp horror, like from that time, like John Carter of Mars, or like we've mentioned before, any Lovecraft novels, Cthulhu Corner. Then we do book differences.
Baseball players.
And we're trying to also, you know, comment on the social commentary within the episodes. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that. Look, we are going to miss some things. That is just the nature of podcasting. That is the nature of covering any show. We apologize if we have missed anything. As we said last week, please, if we have missed anything, obviously leave us a review. That is great. We love reviews, and overwhelmingly they have been extremely positive. So,
but email if us. You do, let us know.
Yeah, exactly. If there's something you feel that we really haven't sort of addressed, or we've really missed the mark on, I want to know personally, and I'm sure you guys want to know as well.
Absolutely,
you can open a dialogue with us 100%. We are not going to bite your heads off. We will happily talk about it. As I said, you can email us at fancriticalpodcast@gmail.com. That is fancriticalpodcast@gmail.com. But I think so far we've done a pretty good balancing act, in my opinion, of everything. And, you know, sometimes when you try and balance everything, yes, maybe some things will get missed. But I think for the most part, it's been pretty good. But as I said, if you really are offended by anything that we've said, you can email us. You know, we're not going to go crazy and shout at you. We are just going to talk to you, like, because we care about the listeners. Like we said, there is no financial gain for this podcast. This podcast is purely because we love chatting to each other, love chatting about the show, and simply want to have a dialogue with you, the listeners. We love listener feedback. We genuinely do. Whether it's positive or negative, it's always interesting to hear people's takes on the show. So please do email us. Good start. Absolutely. Em. Interesting.
Thanks, Lem. Well, look, now that's said and addressed, I think we've got a lot to talk about in this episode. I've managed to watch it 3 times today.
Oh,
which
my
is
God.
Great. So we've got lots of things to talk about.
Also, can I just say, Em, just, I don't want to ruin your structure or anything, but the fact that HBO released this on HBO Max early has thrown us slightly.
Yeah, I was going to have a go at that, I'll be honest, because how are we supposed to reschedule our entire lives for this?
It was very difficult. I know there are some people who were like, yeah, why haven't we released this early? And I get that. But to be honest with you, not many people have access to HBO Max. And
no, we definitely don't.
We definitely don't. We actually can't access it being here in the UK. It's only in a US service. So it was actually extremely difficult for us to cover the episode early. I'm hoping, we've all discussed this, that it won't be a regular thing. And they should go back to the Sundays. So we'll stick to our release window. And I think that's what we have to do.
And it's given me a little bit of extra time to do some additional preparation. Well, look, let's talk about this episode. So, A History of Violence, very interesting title. I would like us to talk about, as always, our overall thoughts of the episode and our blueberry score. So, Lucy, I'm going to come to you first. What did you think of this episode? What is your blueberry score? And please explain the system for those who are eating solid foods and can count.
Shout out to my solid food eaters out there. Okay, blueberry rating scheme system is what we use to rate what we're reviewing. So it's a bit of scheme. That makes it sound underhand.
Sounds like a loyalty
it's
scheme.
Not underhand, it's all above board. So the blueberry system is 0 to 5, 0 being the worst, 5 being the best, and you can't have any halves. So it makes it a harsh but fair scale. Now coming
Very fair.
To this episode, obviously I wasn't on the podcast last week. And just quickly, I thought that last week's episode was actually scary, and so it was an improvement of the week before. This week, I feel like I'm finally getting a handle on what the show is about, and where the story is going. I could be completely wrong, and it could just blindside me again, but I feel like I've let go of my preconceptions and what I was expecting, and I'm just trying to embrace the show for what it actually is and the story it's trying to tell, because I'm the only one here that hasn't read the book, so I'm approaching it completely differently from what you will. And I did get into the story quite a bit more this week, I found, and I think there was quite a lot of interesting themes. I think maybe the feedback that we've got has kind of opened me up a bit more to really trying to see what the story that they're trying to tell, and like the historical representation of certain aspects of the Black experience in America. And although I do still think the show is a bit silly and not scary, really, apart from a few moments last week, I think what I've been expecting it to be scary, but I don't think that's really the way it's going for me anyway. But I thought this was quite a solid episode, and looking at it through the lens of the other episodes, I'm going to give it 4 blueberries, because I do think it's been an improvement on some of the episodes.
Yummy.
The other ones. Yeah, 4 solid blueberries.
That's very solid. Very solid score.
I'm going to go next. Thanks, Luce. I've flip-flopped a bit on my scores since I first watched the episode. I thought this episode was really varied. I thought it was a bit camp in places, but I enjoyed it. It was a bit sort of like Night at the Museum.
That's exactly what I thought.
Oh, God. You could do better than that. You could do better than Night at the Museum.
I thought half of it was really exciting, half of it was a bit confusing, but in a good way, not in a I didn't know what was going on, but this is going to get revealed, what is it? I absolutely loved the soundtrack and the styling in this episode, like Ruby especially. I thought she was amazing. She looked fantastic. The way she holds herself is just fantastic. I'm going to say fantastic one more time, just so we've got three of them. But I think she's brilliant. And I'm really, you know, part of her scenes, and there weren't very many in this episode, made me really excited because I think I know what's coming, but I could be totally wrong. So since my last watch, I've upped my Blueberry score. And I am also, which is unusual for me. I'm going to give this episode 4 blueberries too.
Interesting.
What about you, Lem?
One blueberry.
I'll tell you what, I am struggling. No, I would never do that.
Ten blueberries.
The show is very good. I've given it like an average score of like 4, I'd say. You know, I think I've given a 5, a 4, and a 4. And with this episode, I was struggling a little bit. And I'll tell you what it is. And it's because I know the source material, right? And so does Emma, right? And for me, there's a couple of things that they've done with the story that I think are actually detrimental to the story. And some things to me don't make any sense. Now, talking about things that they've missed out on, and I'm pretty confident they've missed out on this, but you never know, they might surprise me. And this is not a massive spoiler for the book or anything, so don't worry. But in the book, and Emma, you'll agree with me here, there is a very important book that is for the Freeman family, right? Which is essentially their family history through slavery, the end of slavery, and then
it's basically
demanding
the slave debts.
It's their slave debt book, and then they sort of demand with interest how much they are owed throughout history. For all of the horrible things that their family has endured. Yeah. And the book is like this sacred book. So it's an interesting parallel between the Book of Names and also this book of the Freeman family. And the interesting thing about the book is it's you get little snippets of it throughout the novel, and it sounds fascinating. Bits of history, and that's what we, you know, want to see a bit more of. And it's even mentioned in the Tulsa race riots, which was heavily featured in Watchmen, and how George and Montrose have to save the book and stuff like that. And it's very interesting, this sort of, because obviously the Book of Names is becoming more prominent. They're trying to get these pages of the Book of Names, and in the book, that their book is stolen by, you know, Christina, essentially, in little quote marks, because it's Caleb. And they have this sort of trade-off to get the Book of Names, and it gives them much more motivation to get the Book of Names. And for me, it makes much more sense, because this book for them is very personal. And it's also, it would have been a fascinating way to see more of the Freeman history. Now, I have no idea why they cut it. And it feel that for me, the motivation of getting the Book of Names isn't as strong as it is in the book. And I feel like we've missed out on a piece of history. But the episode was very fun in a way. Like, you know, it's gone from horror last week. And I say horror because, Lucy, you're right, it's not really that scary.
It was like, last week, sort of, but horror. Yeah, generally it hasn't been.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's moments. But it has been a bit camp, like we've said. And they've gone down this fantasy horror route, which is
like
absolutely. Yeah, I'm enjoying it as well, 100%. But it's not the horror that we were necessarily expecting. And then this week they've gone full Indiana Jones. You know, this is
All right, better reference, I'll give you that.
Yeah, that's what I meant when you said Night at the Museum.
I mean, it was that as well.
Do you mean like Indiana Jones? Yeah, so they've gone full adventure. I quite enjoy it. Like, just the change of pace. I think that's interesting, covering another sort of form of like science fiction fantasy that Atticus and George and Montrose like to read. That's very interesting and very important to keep reflecting back on their experiences with the stories they've read, and now they find themselves in these stories. I find that fascinating as like a device and a theme that's running throughout the season. So I had a really good time with the episode. But the decision-making at the end of the episode has brought it down to a 3 blueberry for me. And we'll talk about that more as we get on. But it felt bizarre to me to invent this indigenous tribe at the end of the episode, which doesn't happen in the book at all, and it isn't necessary. But the interesting thing is that they brought in this fascinating character that has had, as far as I understand, as a type of character, zero representation in television, like this two-spirited, very interesting character, and then completely sidelined at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
That is a misstep for the show, in my opinion. And, I've heard other opinions out there that say the same thing. Like, if you're going to rescue them from this situation and then you're going to brutally take that character away, for me, that feels like a bit of sidelining, to be honest with you. It feels like a misstep.
Well, I think we can have an opportunity to talk about that.
Yeah, 100%.
And there's a 100%. Lot of elements of this episode that have question marks. I mean, originally for me, it was a 3 blueberry, but when I rewatched it, there was a lot more stuff I picked up on that actually really improved it for me in certain ways.
Look, I really enjoyed the episode. I just want to say, I think the sort of, you know, Indiana Jones stuff was really fun. And the character relationship between Montrose and Atticus is very interesting. And all 3 of them is very interesting as well in this episode. There's loads we can talk about with that. Just the ending for me and that whole situation really confused me. Confused me with why. Yeah. Is the question that I left.
I'm sure we'll
when
find
you've read
out.
The book, when you've read the book, you go, why? That's for sure. But a good episode. Look, it's another good episode. 3 is not a bad score, people.
Not
3
at all.
Is a very good score.
It's not a bad score at all. Well, look, there's loads of stuff in the plot to dive into, and I've already prepared some perplexing questions for you all about certain elements of it. But before we do that deep dive, I'm just going to hand back to Len for a very quick advert break.
Hello, yes, advert time. And here at Lovecraft Country Critical, we have loved the support of the listeners. It's been fantastic. Thank you very much. If you are enjoying this podcast, please do subscribe. Share it with your friends. Post it to any fan groups that you're a member of. And leave us a review. We do love the reviews. I know we talked about it earlier in the episode, but any sort of review is badly wanted by us because we love getting feedback. And so far, it's been overwhelmingly positive. So if you want to leave us those 5 blueberry reviews, go ahead and do it. Just click it now. Apple iTunes, Spotify, whatever. Also to say, if you are enjoying the dynamic between us podcasters and you want to hear us talk about something else, you know, maybe an Avengers movie, maybe, you know, you want to hear about us talking about films that we've never seen before that are mental, like Lucy's not seen Pulp Fiction, and then we discuss
that. How the fuck have you not seen that?
Yeah.
Find out soon.
That is the series. How the fuck have you not seen that? Find out soon. If you want to hear us talk about stuff like that, then you go to Fan Critical. Just search Fan Critical on any podcast app. The link will also be in the show notes. Just click that and click subscribe. We have covered so many things. We've got over 220 episodes on there, from things like Game of Thrones to Westworld to Walking Dead, you know, to the Castle Rock. The list goes on. Stranger Things, everything's on there. So if you fancy hearing the gang talk about stuff like that, just subscribe to Fan Critical. And finally, if you would like to support us financially, as I said, there is pretty much zero financial gain for this podcast.
That's but if you would like to help, that. People support true, us. But if you would,
they do, and we massively appreciate it. And that helps us with things like operating costs, equipment, time to cover other shows that we otherwise wouldn't have. So if you would like to support us further, you can go to patreon.com/fancritical. And on there, you'll see different tiers to get access to bonus content, our Discord server, and even commission podcasts. That's right. You can tell us to commission podcasts. And we do it. No Country for Old Men did that one. Hereditary did that one. Midsommar did that one. World War Z, Inception, Her, all commissioned podcasts. And if you want us to talk about a film, just go to patreon.com/fancritical. And on there, you can subscribe and give us some precious dollary dues to
dollary dues
that we love to cover. And that's it. Thanks very much. Back to Emma in the studio.
Okay. It's time to talk about the episode in depth. Everybody, get ready. Hold on to your hats. Here we go. So this episode opens up with Montrose. He's listening to a radio broadcast about the Soviet Union whilst he's simultaneously remembering George drinking and reading the bylaws of the Order of the Ancient Dawn, i.e. Sons of Adam. So this is basically their handbook. After
it's
reading,
tiny. It's tiny.
It's a pamphlet, isn't it?
You know, it cracks me up because when I read the book, I imagine this massive...
Like tome, like, right?
Tome, yeah. And then they show it here and it's like, it is like four pages.
First rule of Son of Adam, don't talk about Son of Adam. That's it. That's pretty much it. That's all it is.
One of those pages includes what I've called a poem of sorts, and I'm going to read it to you.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Adam named... Eve fucked. God brought forth monsters. Monsters devoured. God smites Eve.
Just Eve.
do we think about this not very poetic bit of scripture?
Misogynistic.
From the Order of the Ancient Dawn.
Misogyny.
Rude,
isn't it?
If anything.
So she Eve very is rude. Fucked and then smote.
Yeah, it is misogynistic.
Where's Adam in all this? Says all about that lot, though.
Yeah, well, this is it, isn't it? This is their thing. They want to return to the primordial ooze, as it were, and the time when things were being created. And they obviously, as Christina has said in previous episodes, don't take the Bible literally, but they...
Yeah, I don't think this is from the good book.
No, but this is their interpretation of it in a way of saying that Eve essentially ruined everything.
And actually what's interesting is that Adam in this has no ownership of that fucking. Eve does.
No. No. Yeah. It's just hammering home. There's two reasons for this. It's hammering home an earlier discussion between Samuel Braithwaite and Atticus. And it's also to help with a puzzle later on.
Yes, we'll talk about that. Well, Montrose is having none of this, so he burns the book. And after he's done that, he remarks that it smells like Tulsa, which is obviously a very clear reference to the Tulsa race riot.
I hope we see that later in the season. Because...
I mean, not because it's, you know, but because it's an important part of their history, not for any other reason. But it is his and George's childhood memories and experience.
We talked about this in the Watchmen podcast.
Yeah, a lot.
Because Watchmen podcast shed light on the Tulsa race riots. And it was evident to us when we were covering that show that... In fact, not a lot of Americans actually knew about the Tulsa race riots, and that show shed a light on it and opened up a very good discussion about why people didn't know about that event. And we certainly didn't know about that event, and we went out of our way, obviously did some research, we had to podcast on a show. And I think this show is doing something similar with certain events. We've already discussed it. Like, it is educating us and educating the listeners at times about things that they didn't know about. Like, we didn't know about sundown towns. We went away and researched it. We discussed it. And I think the show should be applauded for educating people at the same time as entertaining them.
Yep. No, I agree. This is an interesting scene in a lot of ways because there's a lot of stuff here. Lucy, do you think that Montrose is destroying the handbook to protect Tick like George wanted, or do you think there's another reason for this?
I think he's protecting him, and he also knows a lot more than we know, which will lead to his actions at the end of the episode. So there's a lot more to Montrose than I know about. I think he definitely knows, because how long was he there for? Like, I'm sure he discovered a lot when he was in that
couple of weeks.
Yeah, so I think he knows a lot more than he's letting on. He won't tell Tick. He wants to protect Tick, but there is more to it because he's very adamant in his actions. And to go from being a bit of a deadbeat dad, maybe an alcoholic, to cold-blooded murder, there's got to be some motivation behind that.
It's a big shift.
Yeah, it's a pretty big shift.
Big shift. He's an extremely complicated character in the show. I think... obviously you got a fantastic actor in Michael K. Williams.
He's amazing in this episode.
Intense.
Yeah,
genuinely,
So they've given the character of Montrose a bit more interesting range, I feel. Like, obviously the relationship with Tick is integral to the story, it's integral to the narrative, and he wants the best for Tick, but he's loving him in an abusive manner, if you get what I mean.
Very much. And I think that's clear, isn't it?
There's interesting discussions to be had around that, about how he's preparing. He's always been like preparing him for a harsh world, if you get what I mean, like at that time. But, you know, to do that is tough love, essentially. And we know that he loves Tick. I think that's evident anyway, personally. But the
I think also him and George clearly had a very difficult childhood. And I think that he in a way is trying to protect him with that tough love, but it is backfiring badly. But there's some interesting moments between the two of them later on, which I will definitely come back to, because I think their relationship and the development of it for us is really interesting. So after we've seen Montrose, we flash to a title screen scene. And then we move to Christina Braithwaite, who is driving quite nuttily along the streets in the background to Rihanna's Bitch Better Have My Money, I kind of enjoyed. But she arrives at Letty's door. She stops very momentarily to look at this huge white painted word black on the sidewalk outside the house, and then steps over it. I feel quite sort of purposefully and dismissive in a way of going, well, I don't care. It isn't an issue for her. She confronts Letty at the door. She's looking for Hiram's orrery. Now, it sounds like I'm not pronouncing a word correctly.
Can we just stop there? Hiram.
Hiram.
They call him Hiram.
Hiram. You can fucking talk, Glenn. Hiram's orrery. which is the very fascinating planetary thing that Hippolyta's got. But she is blocked from the house by the protections that are on the door left over from the exorcism of Hiram's ghost. Len, what did you think of Christina trying to get in with Letty by throwing out that Tick had tried to shoot Christina?
Yeah, okay, right. They're just spilling their beans a bit here, aren't they? Because there's a bit more mystery in the novel than
more
this.
Nuance.
I don't, and I've said this before, and people can say that I'm wrong or whatever, but I don't like this change from Caleb to Christina Braithwaite. I feel like the character of Christina is very cartoonish at this point, very cartoonish, and the fact that she just goes up to Letty, essentially Letty now knows that she bought the house for her, essentially. That's sort of a bit more nuanced in the book. It's a bit more revealed piece by piece. And they've just gone for it all out here. I hope Christina gets better. I hope the character of Christina gets better throughout the season. I think William's a more interesting character than her, to be completely honest with you. And I just don't like the scenes with Christina in it, and it's I don't know what it is. It's just me.
No, it feels like she's like a cipher for misogyny, and that it almost feels like they're trying to juxtapose her experience as a white woman with the black experience. Yeah. And for me, I find that borderline offensive, because the only people that are more privileged than white men in this world then and now are white women. So the way she tries to be like, well, you know, as a woman, I'm also, you know, have prejudice
she
against
She says that
me.
A lot.
And I
she
think, no, I don't
lot.
Feel sorry for you. Or a white, wealthy woman, like, your woes mean nothing.
Who is immune, who is, like, magical.
Exactly. Just because you weren't allowed in a sect.
I think it's too in your face,
isn't it? Yeah, it's too blunt and heavy-handed.
Yeah, I think that's the thing.
It was interesting, because I was going to ask if you had a different opinion, Lucy, because you haven't read the book. And I think, you know, for Len and I, it's definitely that Caleb, the character, is so much better. But you mentioned William, Len, and actually for me, he's sort of replacing Caleb in that
he's quite mysterious.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He's got creepy. That air of mystery about him and creepiness. Yeah.
Also, Christina is not fucking cool enough to be having Rihanna as her soundtrack. I'm sorry. If that was Letty, fine, but it don't work with her. I don't think she's cool.
Yeah.
She's not a bad bitch, so she shouldn't have Rihanna.
I tell you what, the car is cool though, isn't it?
The car is a cool car. That's a Rihanna car. Yeah.
I did love that silver Buick car.
Definitely. Well, look, we then move on from this, you know, still on the subject of the orrery, which
horrible
is really
word.
Hard to say. So Hippolyta has the orrery, and she's trying to work out how to get it to work while she's on the telephone with her father. And I think it's interesting, and obviously, and this is not as overt in the show as it is in the book, but Hippolyta loves astronomy, and she has
loves
done
it.
Since she
Bloody
was a child.
Loves it.
And so this is fascinating. Something else really interesting happens in this scene as well. So Diana's there, and she shouts out to Hippolyta, "I'm going to Bobo's to read comics." Mm. Now, bear with me, because I think there's a link here. So a couple of episodes ago at the housewarming party, the kids had the Ouija board out, right?
Yes.
And one of the kids asked, would my trip go well? And the answer was no. I think that this links to Emmett Till, whose nickname, one of his nicknames, was Bobo.
Oh, no.
So if you don't know who Emmett Till is, Emmett Till was a 14-year-old young man who was hideously lynched in Mississippi for supposedly offending a white woman in a convenience store, I believe. He came from Chicago.
Do you think that's going to be him?
Yeah. Well, I think it might be. And I've read a few things that have pushed me in this direction as well. But I think now that we've actually had that name come out and that I've definitely read places that he was called Bobo, I think that this might be a very, very subtle reference to a... I mean, I've known about Emmett Till for a long time. It's a hideous story, and it really kind of shows the kind of time they're in. I mean, what do you think? Is that far-fetched? Am I reaching?
No, I love it in terms of if that is what they're doing. That is subtlety, and this is the thing that we're just talking about. Like, the show is very capable of subtlety.
But that's the thing. Like,
in some respects, with the,
you've read about that, Emma, and I'm sure people that are like super familiar with the Emmett Till case would know about his nickname. But that is subtlety, and a lot of the times they'll be like, "Oh, have you heard of that new preacher called Mark?" Or, "Oh no, it's Martin." And it's like you're obviously talking about Martin Luther King, and it's quite like heavy-handed. Whereas this, if that's the case, I think that's done really well. I would not really want to see the case of Emmett Till in this show, because I think it would be absolutely heartbreaking. But you don't know what's coming, do you? Well, I don't. But that's a really good shout. That'd be very interesting.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see where that pans out.
The Hippolyta storyline.
No, please call her Hippolyta.
I have to go with the show pronunciation.
Yeah.
I prefer Hippolyta, but...
I prefer Hippolyta, but, you know, it is what it is. But I love the fact that she's fascinated with astronomy. I love that in the book. I am very excited. I really hope they keep one of the storylines from the book, because it was my favourite part of the book, because it was so Lovecraftian, but it was also horrific, and it was also crazy. And I really want them to keep that, and I'm fingers crossed that everyone gets to see that amazing sequence and they realize it in a good way.
Yeah, no, I agree, without any other spoilers. We need more
exactly
Hippolyta or Hippolyta.
Yes,
pace changes massively here. So Letty is stomping up the sidewalk into the library to confront Tick, which is brilliant. So he's there researching Sons of Adam, Titus, all of that jazz. And they've eventually come to the conclusion that the orrery is the key to finding
Hiram.
I know, but once I get it wrong, I get confused. Finding that his translated pages are the Book of Names or the Book of Adam. So there's a couple of things I want to bring up here. Firstly, how fucking cool is that kid who's reading Journey to the Centre of the
Earth? Very cool.
That kid needs a spin-off show.
He was
brilliant.
Awesome, man. So good. He reminded me of Stranger Things.
Yeah, he had a good vibe.
Yeah, I was really hoping that they were going to add him as a character. Like they were gonna add him to the crew.
Yeah, because he'd have some knowledge.
Because he'd overheard the story, and he... Yeah, exactly. He was brilliant.
He'd be the new George.
Oh, baby George.
Mini George.
So cute. One of the things that comes up here is that Tick just won't let Letty get involved in this. He's trying to protect her, but I think he seems to be forgetting that she's already died once. Lucy, what's your opinion on that kind of, I suppose, friction between them? You know, it comes to a head later on.
I think it's quite well realised, because I suppose maybe it's his military training, maybe it's his relationship with his dad and his upbringing, but he definitely, and she does say it later on in the episode, it's like, you're not the centre of the universe. Like, this doesn't just involve you, this involves me. I literally died. So I'm trying to get to the bottom of this as much as you. So you have to let me help, and you have to, you know, bring me in on this. You can't just do it all on your own. Like, you didn't tell me that the house was fucking bought by Braithwaite. You know, you're not keeping me in the loop when, yes, I was visited by these horrific ghosts that I had to exorcise, and I died previously also. So she needs to be, he needs to keep her in the loop. And I guess he's kind of reflecting Montrose in that way of, no, I'm going to protect you. It's like, well, you're not protecting me, are you? Because I'm not being kept safe by you not including me. So you need to give me more information. So it's, there's a duality between him and Montrose in that respect, I think, in how they're approaching this.
Yeah, definitely.
This.
I mean, Len, what do you think about the chemistry between Tig and Letty? Like, not just in this scene, but in general.
It's very good. It's clear they're doubling down on Tig and Letty, and that's good because we talked about Journey Smollett last week and how fantastic she is. And she just is probably the best character in the show,
yes, she is.
I think. So to have more of her, which we're definitely getting more of her than we do in the book, I think by this point, because of the book's serialized nature, she gets sort of forgotten about quite a lot and sort of mentioned a bit more in sort of by other characters. But it's nice to have her along for the journey. Like, she doesn't go on this sort of expedition in the book, and she's much got her own self-contained thing going on. So to have more of her and Tig is good, and it's only going to enhance the sort of burgeoning relationship that they are creating together. You know?
Yeah. I agree. I think their relationship, their chemistry is great, actually. And I'm, you know, I think there are times when I'm not sure what's going on with Tig, but actually the two of them together, they blow up the screen. I think they're really good. You know, and Letty brings up in this episode, or in this particular scene of the episode, that, you know, Montrose has probably done all this research. You should be speaking to him. So Tig decides to go and find him at the bar. Letty's already there, of course she is. And while Montrose tries to convince him to leave it alone again, he eventually gives up where he thinks the vault is, which will lead us eventually on our main adventure of the episode, all the way to Boston.
Yeah.
But before that, before that, we move back to Christina, who very weirdly is playing hide and seek with a bunch of kids in the street. I don't even know where to go with that. I don't know. It's weird, isn't it?
I thought it would come back episode.
Yeah.
But it does not.
No, it doesn't. She's arrested by a couple of surly-looking cops and taken to the police captain's office, where they have a pretty interesting conversation. So Christina says the orrery wasn't at the house. It's the key to unlocking the time machine.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay.
That's
she also
not
brings
good.
Up, you know, how has he managed to let a black family move in, and keys us into the fact that he is he's in the Sons of Adam.
Sons of Adam.
And he's head of the local lodge. Len, time machine.
Yeah, I'm confused by this. Don't know what that's been a reference to.
No.
Very interested to see. I guess time machine, look, what I thought is we know that they were trying to go back to creation, as it were, or
that's a serious jump in time.
Yeah, well, a plane of creation where everything was getting named. That is what they want to do. They want to go back, and they believe that everything's out of whack, like nature has lost its course because of man, and they want to go back in time. This is me, you know, trying to fumble around this. They want to go back in time to that point to basically be in control and have a say in the order of things, which they believe to be, you know, who knows what order they want things to go in. Probably not a very good one for a lot of people.
I'm going to say now, time machines should never be allowed. It's never a good idea. It always goes wrong and you always fuck up stuff. So leave it alone. Leave the time machine alone.
I did feel like, once again, like, Captain Lancaster is actually, you know, he's an important character.
Yeah.
This scene felt very soap opera to me. I don't know if it felt very soap opera to anyone else. They even like finished the scene by like manually moving into Christina's smirk on her face. And I was just like, this is like Days of Our Lives or something.
That's a great show.
Like,
leave it.
What? I was like, what's going on?
I mean, Lucy, if we end up with a time machine to go back to the, you know, the time of Adam doing his names, how are you going to feel about that?
As soon as the words time machine left her lips, I was like, oh, don't know about that one. Because I feel like I'm trying to get on board, like, yeah, okay, you know, there's wizards, fine, whatever, magic, all right. It's like, oh yeah, but that's the only thing to get the time
love
machine.
Wizards.
I'm like, oh.
You bloody love Harry
Potter.
Yeah,
I mean, that, This is quite like Harry Potter in many ways.
You love Harry Potter.
Yeah, but I'm not expecting Harry Potter in Lovecraft town. Time machine.
If the words came out of her mouth and I was like, no.
It's like ghosts, goblins, time machines. Come on, pick a lane.
Goblins. Goblins. Is that Gaz? We're talking about Gaz again. He's not here this week.
John's the 7 second goblin. He's left. He's quit.
He's gone. Yeah. Okay. Time machine. It's just a no for me. I think you're right, Lynn. They want to go back to creation. But good luck with that.
Yeah. I think it's a figure of speech. That's what I think personally. But
maybe
it'd be interesting.
Well, time will tell.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's terrible, isn't it? Not quite as good as some of my work, my lines.
Not your best work.
So after this, and I had to pause it after this because I was a bit upset about the time machine. we move on to the start of their trip to Boston, where it seems that our gang have picked up some extra passengers. So you've got Hippolyta and Diana, who are coming along to see the observatory and the stars and the constellations at the museum. Good. And then somehow Tree manages
Tree
to
always
hitch a ride, right?
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know. So I thought it was a bit corny, but quite amusing. Did either of you like this bit or did it make you laugh?
I thought they were going to bring him along as cannon fodder. Now, this sounds terrible, but I was
I wish they did.
People are going to have to die. Like, at some point, people actually have to die.
The body
like,
count's quite
you know,
low,
have to
isn't
start
it?
Actually physically killing off some characters. Yeah, exactly. So body I was like, okay, they're going to take him on this little expedition and he's going to die. That was what I was going to do. Or he's going to be some sort of comic relief for them. Like, you know, what the hell are you even doing here kind of character.
What are you doing here?
Turns out he just went to the museum and that's it.
He just wanted a little trip.
Have you got any dinosaurs?
He's there kind of like...
It was so weird.
He's there sort of like as an antagonist to Tick though, isn't he? A bit. It seems to just try and wind him up a bit. Like, he imply that Montrose and Sammy, the bar owner, might be gay?
Yep. And I think that's been... I think that's a confirmation, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
But let's talk about this now, actually, because I haven't included it later. I was slightly perturbed by this, not because, you know, I have anything to do with it, but just that it all of a sudden was like, what? So basically, Tree says, are you annoyed because of what I did at the bar when you were looking for your dad? I sent you out to see Sammy outside and he was with that guy. And, you know, your dad spends a lot of time at the bar and this, that and the other. Basically, just implying that he's gay. Which is, you know, okay, fine. I mean, not a problem. But it just felt really incongruous.
Not a problem to us now, but in those days, I'm sure quite a large problem.
But I also felt like it was just a bit of a kind of curveball
that
didn't seem
comment.
To make sense to me.
I think it was in relation as well to how he knows the security guard here and how he was able to get access. Mm. To the museum. It's out of nowhere, but I thought it was an interesting development.
It was different, wasn't it?
Like I said, I'm not sure if this is the case in the book. I mean, we don't get enough information like that, I'm pretty sure. But what I do know is Montrose is a very complicated character, and this would be a further complication that tries to help you understand how... oppressed he feels he's been during his life, and then why he then enacts that on his son.
Yeah, maybe.
In a way that is something that, you know, we get alluded to the fact that Montrose was beaten by his father. He even
says
so to George,
doesn't he,
in a previous episode. And if this is true about Montrose, then we know that he must feel very insecure within himself because he's fighting several different demons, whether it's his alcohol, whether it's his the fact that he doesn't feel comfortable within himself, if you get what I mean.
Or real demons.
And then he takes that anger out on Atticus and others. And it's a very interesting conversation. It makes Montrose extremely fascinating. And like you said, Luce, at the time, this would have been a massive issue. This obviously now is absolutely fine and celebrated, but at the time would have been a terrible, terrible issue for him.
I hadn't thought of it in that relevance. Like, obviously, I realised that it would have been an issue, but that didn't occur to me that was why they were doing it. It just felt a bit odd. But actually, yeah, you guys are right. That makes a lot of sense.
It's probably just another layer of complexity for him.
Yeah.
Yeah, yep. Montrose is fast becoming, I think, one of the most fascinating characters in this show, which is interesting because he wasn't in the book.
Very interesting.
Yeah, villain or hero, that will be left to be seen. I mean, he's quite villainous at times towards the end of this episode. So
yeah. Well, let's make our way towards that, shall we? But before we do, we'll take a little stop off with Ruby, which I really enjoy her just on screen. I think she's brilliant. So in this scene, she's heading into the department store to apply for a job. So she's talked about this, like lots of chances. She's been doing a CV for it. What she finds is that, as she said, you know, I didn't know they were hiring coloured. You know, there's a coloured sales assistant. She seems pretty peeved and kind of assumes that she's not going to get the job. I thought this was beautiful, and also really sad, because that's the thing that she really wants, is to work there, and now someone has kind of beat her to it and they're not going to hire another black woman. Lucy, what did you think of this scene with Ruby?
I thought it was amazingly shot. I loved the use of the music as well. She just looked fantastic, because I think Ruby, obviously I don't know her relevance in the book, but it seems to me like she has a relevance in the show, but I'm just not quite sure what it is yet. Like, she's being used quite sparingly, but she looked fantastic, and you could see the excitement in the shop assistant's face when she saw her, and she's sort of like, oh, can I help you? It was a nice moment, and I think it's just another side of like the black experience in the US at that time, of the very limited opportunities. And I didn't, but the show and you guys spoke last week about pioneering, and it's not just in housing, it's the black people that have pioneered their way through all walks of life, and this is just another example of that. So this woman has done it, but in doing so she's closed the door for any other woman to do it for the time being. So it's quite bittersweet, like you said, Emma, but it was a really nice nice moment, because it gives you the hope that, okay, progression can be made, but yeah, it's going to take a while for it to be available for everyone.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good way to describe it, actually, and, you know, to explain the feelings behind it, because she's not pissed off that woman got the job. It's just that what that means is, you know, fantastic for her, but it kind of puts a stop, like you say, on everything else.
I mean, she says it to William, doesn't she, later? She says there's something like 103 employees there. They're not going to have two black women. So that's that for me. And when she says, oh, I just applied on a whim. And Ruby's like, ah, I've been planning this for so long. And you just applied on a whim and you got it. Like, it's quite sad.
I felt frustrated for her. I really did. And I really like her as a character, because I like the character of her in the book, I think. But weirdly, because I don't think you're meant to like her that much. So that was definitely interesting. Well, look, let's take a trip to the museum in Boston, shall we?
Yes, please.
So
night at the museum.
We arrive for a day at the museum, actually. Hippolyta and Diana head off to see the stars, and our gang start looking for where the potential vault is. So we've mentioned this. Montrose has a friend who's a security guard. He's going to let them in after dark so they can get in once they work out where it is. So a few things here. The scene with Hippolyta and Diana when they're looking at the constellations, and she talks about how she named that comet, but the credit was given to the daughter of a white astronomer, was brilliant. I mean, you know, Len, you'll remember this story from the book, right? And seeing it come up in almost a kind of offhand way, but it had so much weight.
Yeah, it's nice. It's a nice story from Hippolyta's perspective in the book, and I was like, oh, that, you know, they won't include that, and then they did include it, and I was like, oh, that's very interesting. So they are doubling down on her astronomy and the fact that she loves it so much. Yeah. So
I'm glad.
Fingers crossed for that sequence.
Yes, very much so. I'm keeping everything crossed for that. One of the other things that happens here, apart from Tree talking about his massive wang.
Oh, Tree.
And
why are you here?
Why are you here? We also get introduced to the Titus Braithwaite wing of the museum. There's a tour guide who's talking about him being a famed explorer and how he was taming the savage tribes, which kind of alongside the artifacts in that wing really show the attitude and the actions of both Braithwaite and other people and towards other cultures. Or anything of difference in the 18th century and the time of the show. And I thought it's very difficult to watch because you see people walking past, you know, display cases with African headdresses and things from the Caribbean. And, you know, I thought it was done really well. I mean, Lucy, what did you think about, you know, their first foray into the world of Titus and his artifacts.
I think it was really, really well done. And it's really interesting how not only was he the head of this, like, basically sort of KKK-esque clan, but as a colonizer, that's, you're the ultimate white supremacist, because you're going where you want, you're taking what you want from other cultures because you think they're beneath you. So, you know, yeah, he's saying about how he traded and like won the affections or whatever of the savage tribes, and these things were given as gifts. No, they weren't. They were taken by force. They were stolen. And most museums, let's have it right, are full of stolen artifacts. And here in England, we're the worst for it. We're literally the worst for it.
Absolutely.
Go to a country, take what you want. That's colonizing. And he's like said to be an explorer, and he's not an explorer because he's a colonizer, and he's using his race and his dominance to take what he wants, which is basically the whole ethos of a white supremacist. So I think that was done really well. Like, you weren't hit over the head with it, which sometimes you are in this show. I think it can be heavy-handed. So they didn't say, like, there wasn't any mention of that, really. It was just shown to you, and you can draw your own conclusions. And, you know, there is definitely a juxtaposition towards the end when we see the native tribe and Yahima, the character, of the subjugation of the Native Americans and, like, in the past, and obviously still now, but when they were, like, wiped out, and the treatment of black people and the time of the show and now. So they do that really well, and I think it's beginning to open up a bit more, that it's not just one-off isolated incidents of, you know, aggression and violence, but just a whole society built on this white supremacy, basically.
Very eloquently put, Lucy. Thank you. A complete change of tack here. Can I just ask you guys a question? So when Tree talks about his giant
tree, sorry, every time we say his name, I'm just like, tree.
What stupid,
yeah, big
name.
Tree.
I had to check that was his name. Letty turns around and basically says, well, I'd know that, wouldn't I, seeing as we fucked in high school. Now, hold on a minute. There's some incongruity.
Yes, there is incongruity.
Because is she saying
yeah,
that?
Yeah, no, she's just winding him up.
Is she just
winding him up? Because last week he said to Tick at the party to get Tick jealous about Letty, that he had
we used to tussle.
But we know that she was a virgin until
tussle
last,
could just
last
mean
episode.
Like,
so basically Letty was just like saying, you're a filthy liar, Tree, essentially, and don't you know, drag my name through the mud. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I just wanted to double check it wasn't me being an idiot. I was like,
no,
wasn't she a virgin?
I did think that.
I'm so confused.
Yeah, no. She's heard the rumours that he's been spreading.
Let's get back to Chicago. Well, I think we're in Chicago. So Christina gets home after being with the police captain. And then we get quite an amusing little scene where William comes out and says she don't like being followed, and then beats the shit out of the cops that are sitting out there.
Quite satisfying.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? Really was. Lucy, I mean, we kind of know where this storyline is going because of what it's based on. What do you think, William?
With regards to Ruby? Or just generally in his life?
Like, what's his game?
I don't know. I think it's probably something to do with Tick and his blood, if that's what... But then Christina kind of wants to destroy Letty, doesn't she? So maybe William is acting on her behalf and trying to get at Letty through Ruby. I mean, I don't really know. I think he's going to try and, like, possess Ruby. But to what end, I'm not sure. I have to say, I'm not, like, clear on this.
Okay. Well, keep mulling it over and we'll see what happens.
I'll mull
and that's
further.
That's all I'm going to say on the subject. Len and I have to keep still.
Okay.
So it's nighttime now up in Boston, over in Boston. Letty, Montrose and Tick break into the museum. They find their way down into the vault, which is underneath a big statue of Titus Braithwaite, obviously. Smug fuck. And they open it up using moonlight and reflections that Montrose seems to spot is going to happen. Clearly, he knows more than he's letting on. And then when they get down there, there's an inscription in the ceiling that says, "Beware all ye who tread the path, ever the tide shall rise."
Okay, anyone else thinking about
three pathways?
The Goonies at this point, and when we get onto the boat.
Yeah,
yes!
Yeah. It's in Cthulhu Corner, so don't worry.
Oh, brilliant.
I was going to mention the Goonies.
Of course the Goonies is in
fine.
Cthulhu Corner.
I found that the tomb and the sort of journey to the center of the earth, as Tick says. He says, this is a journey to the center of the earth shit here. I was like,
yeah, we need that kid from the library.
Yeah,
need that kid from the library. That cracked me up. I found the whole, correct me if I'm wrong, but the more like these sorts of films like Indiana Jones.
National Treasure, it reminds me of. I don't know why I've seen that.
National Treasure. It's all right, National Treasure. Don't be mean to it. I kind of like it when the audience is allowed to solve the puzzle the people. And I kind of feel that this show is just not letting us do that. And it's really frustrating me because I love that about these sorts of adventure movies when you're like, when they read out a riddle, you know,
and
even
you're
like Gandalf,
there's that thing.
You know,
just
like
walk on the
Melon,
thing.
Speak Elvish, your friend.
And, it reminds me of Lord of the Rings as well.
Like
the bridge at Khazad Dûm.
Yes, yeah. So I kind of want to be allowed to solve it myself quickly.
Yeah.
But instead, they were like, this is just a minor criticism, but you know, Montrose was like, oh yeah, Moonlight. I was like, how have you figured that one out?
That baffled me.
And then he was also like, nah, this is about which way he went. And we never really got to see the map properly.
Well, this
so,
is the thing, where it was very dark. Like, there are three pathways to choose from. And eventually they decide to choose north because Letty says Titus's last expedition was to the Caribbean in 1810. And then 3 years later, he founded the Sons of Adam. And then what I've written here is it's all a bit too convenient,
it's like
isn't it?
Deus ex machina, isn't it?
And it's a bit, it's that kind of, we talked about the rushing, didn't we? About how quickly things are moving, which is fine. But what you do lose is that kind of being part of the story. You know, there's a really, really clear bit actually that got me annoyed, which was when they get over the edge of the bridge and they like, clearly we're solving it from that little shit poem, but we don't even know what's on the door, and I was really frustrated.
I mean that that was very rough.
I get what you mean.
Solving puzzles is fun, like solving this stuff is fun, it's enjoyable, it makes you feel like you have picked up on this information and then you are using
you're on
it
the
with
adventure
the characters
too.
Instead it was like, like, I love the fact that they showed us the sort of poem that we met, the terrible poem at the start. And then if they'd just shown us the door, even just for like 3 seconds, just let us see the door from a front-on perspective, we can solve the puzzle. Like, but it's a minor criticism because it's all very fun in there and it's all very, like,
it's nice
it's all
to
very,
see,
you know, very
black
Indiana
characters
Jones.
In these situations. And obviously at the beginning of the show,
100%.
Tick does say, doesn't he, like the book he's reading, he's like, black kids from the south side of Chicago don't have these adventures, so it's nice to see him have the adventures, but I agree that, you know, let the audience come on board with it a bit, let us solve the riddle.
It's every week or every episode we're getting black characters put into the positions that usually white characters would be. If it's the haunted house scenario, we've talked about this last week and how it's a nice subversion that you know, Letty and Atticus were in that situation and they were calling on their ancestors to banish the ghost. That's a complete sort of subversion of that narrative. This is the same. We've got black characters in a sort of Indiana Jones, National Treasure, the Goonies type setting, and they are solving the puzzles. They are the tomb raiders, if you will. You know what I mean? It's very... It's great, and hopefully we get more of these sort of subversions of genre throughout.
Absolutely. So we take a very quick break. Ruby's singing angrily in a bar. She's approached by William. He buys her some drinks. He's being pretty presumptuous, offers to change her life. We've talked quite a bit about them, so I think we can probably leave that for the moment. But we've got a big set of scenes coming up here with a lot to talk about. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to rattle through some of the events. Bear with me. And when I eventually take a breath, we're going to talk about it. So we get back to Boston. Our team are off on their tunnel adventure, and this includes a plank over a bottomless looking canyon, a trick, a dissolving plank, a locked door with buttons to press and solve, water, the floating body of Letty's neighbour, apparently, a very familiar lift, a father and son heart to heart about women, a ripped off arm in the lock to what we assume is the vault, and Tick's blood opening up the door, obviously. Guys, opinions, go.
It's fine. It's all pretty good. It's all pretty fun. It's varied in terms of an adventure. I'll talk about it later in Cthulhu Corner about the differences in the book and how I think the book potentially did it better. But maybe that's my imagination. But yeah, it's very good. Like, it's just complete change of pace from last week. It's just, if you had said, like, this is the thing, if John was here, he'd be like, what is going on in this show? Because for is we talked about it, it's whiplash. It's yeah. like, 1 week, you're on a horror, so episode two, you're wizards. Episode three, you're haunted house. Episode four, you're an adventurer, you know,
yeah.
delving into the tombs of a Boston museum. And, you know, you've probably got Ben Stiller behind you and a talking Robin Williams. You know, what's going on? So, yeah, so basically it's very whiplashy and you just have to be along for the ride, as it were.
It always feels like a slightly classier Scooby-Doo or Famous Five.
It is quite Scooby-Doo, like, yeah.
Thing. Yeah, that door does open the entrance to the vault, which yep. is something else completely, right? So it looks like the inside of Titus's ship. And
yeah, it's cool. That,
it's
that
really
cool.
And it's filled with like hammocks and food and drink and mummified skeletons. Each of them look to be indigenous people from the areas that he travelled to, including really horribly a mother and a baby. So they're coming through this and it's really grim. They spot the scroll of what they assume to be the pages from the Book of Names. And we then meet a very interesting new character called Yahima. Who comes to life when they try to take the pages. And what Yahima says is that Yahima is woman, man, two-spirit. And I'm not quite sure of the correct pronoun to use for Yahima, so I'm going to use they.
Yes, that's probably the best.
Yeah.
They speak in what we assume to be the language of Adam, which Tick understands, and Yahima is understandably fucking furious with Titus because we get the story that he tore them away from their homeland, trapped them here on the ghost ship to rot and die. I have to say, you know, we talked about the ending and how jarring that is because this is fascinating. And a very important, you know, extension of what we talked about before. It's disturbing, it's distressing, it's pretty dark. And I there's a part of me that felt like I should have expected this from the, you know, colonial whitewash of Titus. But I really wasn't. And it hit me really hard. And I found, and even the second time it hit me harder, I think, watching Yahima come back to life and tell that story through Tick. I mean, Lucy, how did this kind of reveal and set of scenes hit you?
I think I actually found it a bit confusing as to who they were, why they came back to life. And it was quite exposition heavy, the explanation as to why they were on the ship or the tomb. I found it a bit. It's that thing of I'll tell you rather than show you, and yeah,
it's a rushed situation, taking them
from their home so he can translate stuff, the Book of Adam or whatever it was. I'm still unclear as to why they were all there, to be honest. And why did they come back to life? Is that a spell just to defend the scroll?
Because I think it's kind of like, it struck me a bit like, you know, the moment anyone goes near the pages, they're enchanted to come back alive. It just felt for me like, and I'll talk about this just briefly, I guess, but like, it's just not in the book, right? And I get what they're going for, and I think they did a more eloquent job of the situation talking about Titus and how he was a colonizer and a massive white supremacist just by going through the wing in the museum. And Lucy talked about that very eloquently, so I don't need to really ad lib on that. But what I will say is, like, this just for me, to bring this interesting character to life and then take away is terrible, to be honest with you. I'm at a loss to think about how in the writer's room they came up with that decision to add something in like this.
That has so
and
much
then
depth.
Take it away.
It was so interesting, really, as a concept of a character. It was I've never seen that before on TV in that form.
I've never seen it. Never. And I feel like I just don't understand, because I would understand it if it was in the book, right? I would understand it completely. Like, they're sticking to the source material. That's fine. But there's nothing to do with this in the book.
Well, it's like, almost nothing. Like,
I mean, there's not even a link to it. There's not even a line that links to it. It is a completely show-made situation to hammer home, I guess, the fact that Titus Braithwaite was a colonizer. He was in the shipping trade. He was a horrible, horrible man.
He was in slave trade. Also, yeah, they're exactly, all slave trading countries.
Yeah, that's exactly.
It
that's
almost what, yes, felt a bit like a show version replica of what had happened to Yhemah in the first place. She's dragged into this thing. She's dragged onto this ship. She's like suspended animation. Then they're taken out of where they've been for however long and dragged off into someone else's world without really giving their permission for it, and then murdered. And it is, it's basically the same thing happening to Yhemah all over again.
It's a shame because I think this show with its messaging, I think this show with its social commentary, I think it's doing a fantastic job at educating the audience. And I've talked about this earlier, about certain events and about trying to understand and put yourself in these characters' shoes as best you can. And I think the novel does a great job of that as well, making you try and interpret these events from the character's perspective. And then to have all of that great work that the show is doing, and then I think to undercut it with this very bad editorial decision, I think, is a shame. And look, there might be a very good explanation for it next week, so I don't want to pass too much judgment on it until I've seen the fallout from this action. And then once I've seen that fallout from the action, I'll make a more judged opinion on it, because I think until we see the ramifications for the characters, for Montrose, understand where he's coming from, then it's difficult to... at the moment, it's difficult to excuse his actions, but maybe there is an excuse for some of his actions. I don't think it'll ever be fully excusable, but I do think maybe next week we'll know more.
I hope
about why.
We get a bit more explanation for it. But yeah, I guess we just have to wait and see, don't we?
I mean, it's a shame. I wanted to see more of Yhemah personally. Listeners, let us know what you think. I wanted to see more of Yhemah. So that's
luckily it. They all escape in the elevator. We do have a slight mishap and some of the pages float off, but Letty goes and rescues them.
Weird.
There is a very dramatic snog between Letty and
I
Tick.
Thought there was going to be a shark.
Yeah, I thought there was going to be some
shark
kind of
or a Lovecraftian water monster. Yeah, I wanted like a Lovecraftian monster,
like a squid,
in the water. Now, you know.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah,
yeah, that's what I was expecting.
A Cthulhu.
Yeah, it sort of felt like there was going to be some kind of underwater monster that was going to stop them. But no, they get out, and apart from a very piercing scream from Yhemah, they make it out of the top of the lift all in one piece. We very quickly switch to Hippolyta and Diana. They drive back from Boston and they're like, well, how do they get back to Chicago without us? Never mind, carry on. Diana's sitting in the passenger seat and she's drawing on George's map from the glove box. Hippolyta looks over and she's like, where'd you get that? And then looks at it. She sees a red circle at the end of a traced journey around Devon County and the route that basically they all took. So seeing this, she turns the car around and drives off saying, we're going to get answers. I really liked this. But, I mean, Lucy, what do you... Because she doesn't really know what's happened to George, just knows he died in Devon County. Do you think that's where she's heading? Do you think that's what's going on?
I mean, first things first, wouldn't you be so pissed if you drove everyone there and they're like, oh, yeah, we're home. How the fuck did you get home?
100%. What? It's not like we've all got cell phones. You'd
literally
like,
be fuming.
Just headed back now.
This scene actually filled me with quite a lot of dread. Looking at that map and thinking about sundown towns and just two women on their own, two black women, I was filled with quite a lot of dread. And the thought of her going there. She's not got over, obviously, not got over George's death, but she knows that there's more to it that no one's telling her. So I don't blame her for wanting to go and investigate, but I'm a bit terrified for them because there's no good going to come of you heading back to that town, that area.
It was just that portent of fear, wasn't it?
Yeah, like, I found it very,
you know,
like,
what is there?
The pit of my stomach, like, oh God, please don't. Didn't know what was going to happen when the realisation struck of what they were looking at. And yeah, it is night time and just, but yeah, I also thought I'd be very annoyed if everyone just left without telling me and they're already home.
I'm intrigued to see where this goes with Hippolyta and Diana, because it may lead to the thing that Len and I are looking forward to. which would be very interesting.
Yay.
Or it may lead to disaster in sundown towns and Devon County. Who knows? Our final scene, which we've probably talked about enough, but I'm going to just quickly take us through it. Tick seems really positive now they're all back in the Winthrop house about maybe teaching Yhema English, working on translating the pages with Yhema. And Montrose gives this kind of quite a positive speech about how his mama would be proud of him and he's a good, Tick's a good man. And then he goes and slits Yhema's throat and we get no explanation and that is how the episode ends. And it was brutal. But I was also baffled. Again, you know, like we
said.
We've
talked about it a bit. I've got two more comments from it. My literal reaction watching it was like, and I said it like John would say it. I was like, why? Like that. I literally said it out loud when I watched it. And I thought, God, John would have been saying exactly the same thing.
Oh, John would be fuming.
And then it's interesting as well. It's like Montrose is sort of, we've talked about how he was abused when he was younger. We've talked about how he was oppressed. And it's like now he is the oppressor in this situation, mm-hmm. if you get what I mean. He's acting like a colonizer, just killing the other, as it were, something that he doesn't
so
understand.
He's not brutalizing, but he's like, I can use this person for my own gain and I can get them to translate, which is exactly what Titus did. So he's doing the same.
Never asked them.
So it's
no. It's just, I'll take you. I'll punch you, so and then you can translate some bits for me. But isn't that what Titus did?
Yeah, we didn't mention that. That was rough.
I mean, she was screaming, but yeah.
So that's that. Yeah. So that's an interesting way of looking at it, I guess. Maybe that's what they're going for in terms of the narrative. It's controversial. Look, this is controversial.
Mm.
You know, what we said is just controversial. And I'm pretty certain that the scene is controversial. It's all controversial. So it's going to cause a lot of debate. Let us know your thoughts. You can email us.
Yeah, totally.
fancriticalpodcast@gmail.com.
I'd be really interested to hear some answers to the question, why?
Yes. But
just why?
Why?
look, I think we've given that plot a pretty deep dive today. And I've really enjoyed talking about it. But what I'm really excited about, it's handing over to Len for Cthulhu Corner and listener feedback.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Cthulhu Corner, all hail Cthulhu.
Cthulhu.
Now, this week, interesting stuff because it kind of deviates from the sort of horror vibe quite a lot. So instead, in Cthulhu Corner, we've gone for, and we've already mentioned a lot of them, a list of the films that this is referencing.
Yes.
Yeah. Because this is more of a a romp, as it were, in terms of an adventure story.
It's like geeky pop culture references.
Yeah,
like love.
Yeah, it's not often that like Lovecraft or any of these other pulp science fiction writers did something like this. So, so we've talked about Indiana Jones, specifically Raiders of the Lost Ark. Obviously, I mentioned it already, but National Treasure 1 and 2. And look, I think National Treasure is a good film, so don't knock it. I think it's one of Nicolas Cage's best films.
But
I love
it.
I actually really enjoy National Treasure. That's all like the... No. You guys mentioned Night at the Museum, which I thought was silly, but then when I actually think about it, it's literally a Night at the Museum.
It's 100%. It is the Night at the Museum, which is a great film.
Yeah, good film.
This is all that is.
I mean, how many Night of the Museums
17.
Are there? Like 6 or something?
They're all as good as
now,
each other.
I've only
just
seen the
silly.
First
it's
one.
It's like the kids' version
Journey
of Fast and the Furious.
But better.
Yeah. Journey to the Centre of the Earth, which Tick literally references, and The Goonies, which was, you know, Lucy took it away.
I'm sorry.
I thought it'd be fun to mention The Goonies. So, The Goonies, you know, this was very Goonies.
Yeah, it was.
It was
love
very
The Goonies.
Goonies.
Yes. Brilliant.
I love The Goonies. Who doesn't love The Goonies?
Hey, you guys.
If you don't love The Goonies, let us know, because that is mental.
Yeah, let us
if
know
you haven't
then,
seen The Goonies,
never again,
how the fuck have
upset.
You not seen that?
Oh, if you
That's
haven't seen
worse.
The Goonies, go watch The Goonies.
Oh my God, yeah. That is the worst one. If you've not seen The Goonies, terrible.
Lovecraft-wise, we're sort of, there's not much here to draw on. I was, the only thing that came to my mind was like The Nameless City. That feels like quite a hidden away sort of otherworldly dimension town thing that we're getting here, this weird catacombs that Braithwaite has built. And
there's a couple of stories that have that underground, you know, like big chasm of darkness, yes. Different yes. paths to take and things like that. It's quite a Lovecraftian trope.
Yeah. And the thing is as well, and this will segue us into book differences, but when they go on this sort of adventure in the museum, and they find this doorway which Tick can open with his blood, which is obviously very similar here. It is other dimensional. Like straight away, these guys are like, "This is another. We're in another dimension. We're in a space within a space," and it's very Lovecraftian that way.
It doesn't adhere to the normal rules of life.
No, it doesn't adhere to normal rules of like gravity and other stuff like that. And like that, they acknowledge that this is like another dimension, which I don't really think you get in the show. I think they're kind of just like, oh, it's this hidden underground tomb that sort of goes along for a while. Also to say, there's a bit more of an entourage that go on this journey. Letty isn't there. It's more sort of the Freemasons.
It's Tree there.
George is there. Montrose is there. Atticus is there. Abdullah is there, who's another character from the Freemasons that they're a member of. And it's a bit more puzzle solvey. Like there's,
yeah, it's really good.
Basically, there's this chest in the center of this expansive other dimensional room,
and it's floating.
And there's a floating, There's a floating corpse of someone who's obviously tried to get the chest, and there's no platform to the chest, and they have to figure out a way of navigating gravity. And then there's this giant mechanical sort of saw monster that flies around the room.
It's like
and
a
tries
flying circular
them.
Saw.
Oh, that doesn't.
It's terrifying.
And it's kind of, yeah. It's did you say it sounds great or it doesn't
no,
sound great,
I mean,
Lucy?
It's really scary.
Yeah,
it's scary.
It's bad.
So it's kind of cool. I didn't really go down that route here. But I still like what they did in the show. I think it's, you know, they've gone for a more of a sort of, like we said, Indiana Jones adventure type story, which is fine. I think it works pretty well. So in the book, it's actually Caleb Braithwaite who seduces Ruby. And we know that they've changed that character to Christina. And now it's William who's tasked with seducing Ruby. And essentially, William is kind of Caleb Braithwaite in a way.
I'm quite glad that they didn't swap the storyline to Christina. Not because that would have been... Yeah, but I feel like that would have been...
Oh, that would have been interesting.
I think it feel like it would have been too in your face, because Christina's already very much, I am a woman, I don't have rights.
Yes. yeah.
I think it would have been too heavy-handed. So I like the fact they swapped it for William.
Yeah. And we've mentioned this already. There's no indigenous tribe in the book, by the way. That whole thing, like I said, it's a chest in the middle of the room. Just to clarify, they get it, and then they escape, and they get caught by Christina. Okay, that's what happens. And Hippolyta goes to a different location that I won't mention here, as it still might happen. But she never intends to go to Arden. In fact, you don't really go back to Arden, do you, Em?
No, not really.
Not at all. So that's the book differences. Obviously not spoiling anything that happens in the future, because we don't like doing that here. But it's time to move on to some listener feedback.
Woo!
And
yay!
Woo! Yes, you can email us at fancriticalpodcast@gmail.com. The email is in the show notes, so just click on that, email us, let us know your thoughts on the episode. Okay, let's kick off with some feedback. This one's from Andrew Mayer, and he says this. Hello, I'm a brand new listener who just started listening with Lovecraft Country. I tried a few Lovecraft Country podcasts before deciding that you guys were the best out there. Thanks, Andrew.
Welcome to the group.
Cheers. Welcome to the Blueberry crew. Thanks for the content. Honestly, I've been enjoying the podcast even more than the show. Great. I do want to take a second to stick up for John, though. I was sad when I heard no one should ever stick up for John. No, I'm joking. I was sad when I heard he was not going to be continuing on Lovecraft Country. During the first Lovecraft Country episode, John said something funny. And that comment made me stop the podcast right where I was and subscribe.
Wow.
I will definitely miss him. Perhaps he should reconsider. John is a very funny man. He's a very grumpy
funny
man. He's a very
man.
Funny man. This is me. This is me talking, not Andrew. and he might come back.
He's not coming back.
You never
back.
Know. But at the moment, he's very
Sorry,
much
Andrew.
Of the opinion that
You're
he's
stuck with
not
us.
Coming back. But I respect his opinion that if he's not enjoying the show,
yeah, totally.
it's obviously difficult for him to watch a show, make notes on the show, come here and try and he doesn't want to like put
no,
down
it becomes
what we're
a
saying
chore
all the
if
time
you're really
because
not
he
enjoying
feels
it.
That like it yeah, and he doesn't want to make it a chore because he loves the podcast, he loves podcasting, he doesn't want to make us feel bad about why we like it either. If you get
and
what
we
I
joke
mean,
about him being the grumpy
like
one,
it.
But actually, he's not always grumpy. But Andrew, if you like his wit,
like John,
then there's plenty of other podcasts you can listen to.
Oh, 100%. If anyone's missing John at the moment, as I said, please do go subscribe to our main channel, Fan Critical, where John is a mainstay in most of our podcasts. So he's also said, Andrew goes on to say, and for what it's worth, I certainly don't mind hearing negative opinions. In fact, I'm the sort of person who likes to be very critical of even the art that I like the most. And I'm sure there are plenty of other people in your audience who feel the same way. So I guess you can count this as one vote for negativity. Regards, Andrew.
Nice. Love it.
Minneapolis. That is the thing. I don't want to sound like we're the only critical podcast out there because we're not. But there are a lot of podcasts out there who just go, this show's amazing about a lot of things. Mm. And I listen to a lot of podcasts that refuse to really go on in at a show if they think it's done something incorrectly. I think at least I know that we always cover things to the best of our honest opinion. And yes, it doesn't always align with 100% of our listeners. You know, we get conflicting blueberry scores all the time from listeners. And it's fascinating to hear that. So, you know, I like the fact that we're critical.
The clue is in the name.
The shows that
the
we
whole
cover.
Point of the That's name, cool. Fan Critical.
It's the whole clue's in the name. Yep. Clues in the name, everyone.
Ah,
so,
nice feedback.
Yeah, no spoiler. Yes, thanks, Andrew. Yorick's written in. Yorick Chapbourne has written in and said
Best
this.
Name.
Five bloobs for me. Your podcast. I'd give the episode a solid 4. So it's given the podcast 5. That's good. I'm having a great time watching this show and listening to you all afterwards. And kudos to you, John, for bailing out. You're clearly not enjoying the show, and I think it was the right move. Don't get me wrong. I very much look forward to hearing you discuss the next show that you're truly excited about. When you're having fun, you bring so much to this podcast. If you do start that Splinter podcast you mentioned, I assume it will be called something like Lovecraft Country Sucks, and here's why. I'll definitely hit subscribe and give it a listen. Even if I disagree with everything you're saying. Why? Because then you're in your element. Brother, you're hilarious.
Not
there
John,
you go. John,
please.
Yeah, you're probably... I wonder if John... We have to say this to John, probably, because he'll never listen to this. Yeah, it's good. It's good. There you go, John. Don't feel so bad. He also goes on to say, finally, can I nominate Emma to host all of your podcasts from now on? I mean...
Yes.
Here are 3 reasons why from your last episode. Speaking of black and white, greatest segue possible while discussing the show about racial tensions. Shut up, I'm moving on, which is putting a lid on jokes about women and the missing jaw. Nicely done. Cat's got her tongue was intended a pun too many. Yeah, so good. I'm the host, I can do what I like after being called out by Gaz for avoiding John for 20 minutes. Damn right you are. Excellent podcast. Can't wait to hear more. R.I.P. John.
Thanks,
yes,
Yorick.
Yes, R.I.P. John. Thanks, Yorick.
I'd love to host them all, but you know, it's a democracy here and I don't get paid enough.
It's true.
It's a lentatorship.
It's not a lentatorship.
It is a bit.
This is not a lentatorship. Five blues.
To be fair,
five blues.
I haven't hosted a podcast like other than a How the Fuck Have You
Not
Seen
That for a long
time.
And the ratings speak for themselves.
Now.
So
yeah, pull your weight.
Maybe we should keep Emma on.
Shut up. Tara's been in touch and she said this. Hello, everyone. I'm excited to be watching another show along with you guys. Just wanted to drop in and give a bit more of an American perspective on the show.
Is it Tara
a
Red
best
Apple?
To keep this... Yep.
Yeah, yes. Have a lovely name.
She says she'll do her best to keep this non-political. One Easter egg you guys missed was during the housewarming party, a young boy, Bobo, who we've mentioned in this episode, playing Ouija, asked if he'll enjoy his trip was Emmett Till. He is falsely accused of whistling at a white woman while visiting a family in Mississippi. He is then lynched. His murderers were found not guilty, but afterward confessed to the murder. His mother shared pictures of him open casket and the press with the press and was in large a reason the civil rights movement happened. So just to stop that email there, Emma, you did obviously mention that this episode. So that's obviously a horrific story, and there was a further link to it in this episode. So tough stuff. As mentioned by a previous listener, American history books are largely controlled by conservative states, but the reason it's that way, at least at the start, wasn't because of money issues. It was intentional misinformation put out by a group called Daughters of the Confederacy. They would pressure books to be removed or labelled unfair to the South.
I've heard about this.
Another thing, that's very interesting. Another thing that was mentioned was Martin Luther King's affair with a white woman. Interracial marriage wasn't federally legalised in America until 1967. The aptly named case, Loving versus Virginia King, was living in a southern state where his relationship would be criminal. And lastly, if you have ever watched the show Shameless, you can see how racist Jim Crow policies shaped America cities such as Chicago. Things like redlining still have an impact to this day. The Gallaghers are from the South Side, which was purposely made / kept a ghetto for racist reasons. I hope this information is helpful to someone if you haven't read these things before. I highly recommend you do. Thank you again, the Fan Critical crew, for all the entertainment.
Thank you, Tara.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Tara.
Although,
yeah, it is interesting.
Being British, you said if you've ever seen Shameless, I was thinking, how the fuck is that relevant to this? And then I realised they've got an American version.
English version of Shameless.
Yeah, totally.
If you haven't seen that, guys, watch that.
And then it's a good show.
No relevance to what we're talking about.
But it's a great show, yeah.
It's a great show. No, the stuff about books, I think, is fascinating to me. About, like, that is something that obviously, as British people, we just don't understand. Like, we don't know much about your school system, and to hear this from several different people now about how the books are neglecting certain information, or there's pressures from certain different states to withdraw or manipulate some of the history is fascinating to me.
And that did happen and does happen here to an extent.
Yes, it does.
So in terms of the curriculum, what is focused on and what's not. But I didn't realise. You can never assume that it's the same somewhere else. So it's interesting to hear that confirmed, and the detail behind it, the particular organisations and groups of people who pushed for certain things to happen that way. Really interesting and great feedback to get.
Great feedback. And that's it for feedback this week, because we're running very long. Please do let us know your thoughts. I'll try and get it in next week's episode if I can. You can email us at fancriticalpodcast@gmail.com. That is at fancriticalpodcast@gmail.com. Just email us there. The link's also in the show notes. And then, like we said, we have a little discussion, get your feedback read out on air and have us discuss them. Good stuff.
Absolutely. Thank you, Len. That was an awesome Cthulhu Corner and awesome feedback from everyone who wrote in. And if we didn't get around to reading your feedback, we'll make sure to get it in next week. But thank you guys for taking the time to talk through this episode. I think it's been a really good opportunity to talk about lots of different things and learn things too. So please do subscribe to the channel, leave us a review, you'd send us your feedback, follow us on social media. But for now, it's time to say thank you and goodbye from Lovecraft Country Critical. Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.